You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
All right, first order of business. Let's get right to it. Hello, Olympia, Washington. Very proud to welcome a new affiliate, KGY AM 1240 in Olympia. Welcome to The Conspiracy Show. Very, very pleased and very proud to have KGY as part of our a growing family here on The Conspiracy Show. We'll add that to, I believe that brings our total to 15 affiliates south of the border. And delighted to have them all, each and every one from Kodiak, Alaska, which we welcomed last week, KVOK AM 560, Huntsville, Alabama, Phoenix, Atlanta, Davenport, Iowa, Springfield, Missouri, Hanover, Claremont, New Hampshire, Albany, Beacon, Kingston, Peekskill, New York, Asheville, North Carolina, Bismarck, North Dakota, and of course our brand new one, KGY AM 1240. Tim Spreen, our very capable technical man and producer here on The Conspiracy Show, open up the phone lines because the first hour, it's just you and me, friends. And I do have something on my mind, and I'm hoping you'll be interested in chatting with me about it. Obviously, these are very uncertain times, and the situation unfolding in the tiny island nation of Cyprus really has me concerned, and it should have you concerned as well. Cyprus, you're saying, that's half a world away. It's a tiny little country, 800,000 people. What could that possibly have to do with me? Well, if you've been following what's been going on over there, it could have a lot to do with all of us. Because I think what's going on in Cyprus, as they scramble to avoid some sort of a meltdown and possibly risk being turfed out of the EU, although it looks like now that's not going to happen, the Troika, the EU, the IMF, the dreaded IMF, and the European Central Bank have essentially told the Cypriot government, you will impose a tax on the depositors at the two largest banks in that country to shore up its failing bank financial system. And a lot of that money, of course, is, as we've come to learn, Russian money, KGB money, Vladimir Putin money. the latest deal is this. Most depositors in Cyprus will be spared after the Cyprian parliament basically said, no, we are not going to impose a depositor tax, which was anywhere from, I think, 6.9% upwards to about 15%. They weren't going to impose that tax on ordinary depositors, to which the Troika responded, if you don't do something, you're out of the EU. Well, now it looks as if only those depositors with money in the two largest banks over $100,000 or 100,000 euros, my mistake, 100,000 euros will have to pay upwards of, get this, 40%. 40%. In addition, Cyprus has imposed a capital controls. In other words, because obviously if you had more than 100,000 euros and you knew this was coming down the pipe, you would be scrambling to the bank to withdraw your money. So they've put in place these capital controls. You can only withdraw up to 100 euros from an ATM. And if you were to go to the bank, I'm not sure what the controls there are. But in other words, they're preventing people from taking their money out of the bank. And of course, the first people in line would be these former KGB people, because Cyprus is sort of the new Cayman Islands or the new Switzerland, and the KGB, of course, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, you had this sort of gangster capitalism that emerged in Russia, and a lot of KGB people. However, they did it. They acquired a great deal of wealth, and I would include Vladimir Putin in that, and they parked their money in Cyprus. So now you had the Cyprian parliament placed in this position where they were told essentially to put a depositor tax on deposits, which was really going to hurt, kick the Soviets or kick the Russians in the pants, which was, I guess, sort of a nice or an opportunity for the IMF to do this. When I say IMF, what we're really talking about here is Washington, the International Monetary Fund, headquartered in Washington. This was a rare opportunity for them to kick their former Cold War foes in the pants with this depositor tax. But I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned for the members of parliament in Cyprus, because I suspect the former KGB and the Russians, who have a lot of money, we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars in Cyprus banks, aren't going to take this lying down. I suspect we're going to see, I hope not, I suspect we're going to see a few Cyprian parliamentarians floating face down in the Mediterranean. Because these guys play rough, let me tell you that. However, what's going to happen, I suspect, is depositors in Greece, in Spain, in Italy are looking at Cyprus and saying, we could be next. Are they going to tax my deposits? I mean, guaranteeing, a bank guaranteeing your deposits, that's sacrosanct. That's the rule of law. And now what we have essentially is theft. We have the IMF, the European Central Bank, the EU, demanding that the Cyprian government steal money from their own depositors. This could very well cause a run on the banks in places like Greece, in Italy, in Spain, in Portugal, in Ireland. And it could cause banks to fail. And we could see a ripple effect that could turn into an economic tsunami that could make the economic collapse of 2008 look like a walk in the park. And what I'm asking you, ladies and gentlemen, and I invite you to the phones, are you concerned? Are you prepared for a possible financial collapse? Are you confident that your deposits in your bank are safe? Now, having said that, here in Canada, we have probably the most stable banking system in the world. Our debt to GDP ratio is relatively low compared to other countries in the G7 or G20. I don't foresee a financial collapse in Canada, but I would ask my American listeners, how do you feel? Do you think it's within the realm of possibility that one day you'll wake up and be told, the banks are closed for an extended banking holiday? The banks in Cyprus have now been closed for more than a week. Imagine if you had no access to cash. How are you going to pay your groceries? How are you going to pay your electricity bill? Imagine waking up and being told, banks are closed for a week. When they reopen, your $100,000 is now worth $60,000, so you're taking a 40% haircut, and you can only withdraw $100 a week. Do you think that could happen? In Canada, probably not in the foreseeable future. In the United States, what do you think? Regardless, I think that the situation in Cyprus will look back, and I follow a number of forecasters and financial analysts on a website called kingworldnews.com. people like Eric Sprott and Jim Sinclair, and Gerald Celente, who contributes. And Gerald Celente will be on this program in the coming weeks, one of the great trend forecasters anywhere. And what they're saying is that the situation in Cyprus, we'll look back on this one day, and it'll be compared to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand in Serbia back in 1914 as that pivotal event, which of course led to World War I, but it was a domino effect. The situation in Cyprus, as it is unfolding now, could have a similar import. It may be one of the most significant events in modern history. It could lead to the unraveling of the EU. It could be the IMF's greatest blunder. It could lead to a run on banks, bank failures. Are you prepared for a financial collapse? Are you fearful of a financial collapse? And if you are, how are you preparing? What do you do if you wake up and you don't have access to your own money? Do you own physical gold? Do you own silver? Is that something you would consider? How bad do you think it's going to get? I own some what we call paper gold. I have a percentage of my investments in mutual funds, and those funds hold stocks in gold mines and silver mines and we don't own physical gold. There was a time, of course, when the dollar was backed by gold, of course, and silver. Nixon finally took the United States off the gold standard back in 1971. A lot of people are advocating we need to get back to that point. I don't know if that'll happen in our lifetime, but I tell you what, this financial system that we're living under for the last 100 years is a Ponzi scheme. It can't go on forever. All paper money eventually collapses, and then we have to hit the reset button and start over. And I believe that we are nearing that point again. So when we come back, we'll take your calls. Let me throw out the numbers now. These are always handy. 416-360-0740. 416-360-0740 in the Greater Toronto Area and toll free from just about anywhere. 866-740-4740. You're listening to The Conspiracy Show. My name is Richard Serrett. I look forward to your voices. Welcome back, and asking, are you prepared for a possible financial collapse? Now, some may say that we're sounding the alarm bells unnecessarily. I don't think so. I mean, I think you should always be prepared. I remember my father, who had lived through a depression and served in the Second World War, and back in the 70s, 80s, you know, we'd gone through an energy crisis and a recession, but nothing like what we're facing right now. And he had this room in the basement of our home in Brantford. It was sort of his work room. He had his tools in there, but he saved everything, little pieces of string and little pieces of metal. And I remember he used to manage a shoe store. We always had nice shoes. When I outgrew a pair of shoes, I would, if they were a little tattered, I would throw them out. And years later, after my father passed away, it took us years to clean out his room. He had saved so many things and packed so many things away. And I remember opening the closet and finding just about every pair of shoes I'd ever owned and thought I had tossed out. Because he remembered what it was like during the dirty 30s. He remembers how times were so tough that you didn't throw things away. And I remember going through his things and finding I don't know if you remember these. They were called Sterno stoves. Sterno was a fuel that you could burn essentially allowed you to cook on this little stove. It was for camping, but he bought 7 or 8 of them and it stashed them away. I guess in the back of his mind, he was thinking it could happen again. Are you prepared? Lee is in Ohio. Hey, Lee, welcome.
On the air.
You are on the air, sir.
Thank you. I've been looking for a meltdown about 30 years. I've invested in gold many years ago when it was just half of what it was worth now. I live where I'm completely self-sufficient, so I look for an economic turn and also like society in general to like decay.
Well, if things get really tough, I think it's pretty safe to assume that there will be this societal decay. I think we'll see panic in the streets in places in Europe. If, for example, in Greece, Spain, Portugal, they begin to become fearful that there's going to be a tax on depositors. That could spread.
It starts with the weakest economies and infrastructures, and then it builds, it goes outward. So America would probably be the last for that to happen, but it will start where it basically is starting now.
Well, here's the interesting thing. You know, the dictate coming in Europe from the Troika, one of the Troika is, of course, the IMF. Well, who is the IMF? It's Washington. It's the same people that are involved in the Federal Reserve and many of the large banks in the United States making these decisions in Europe. So who's to say it couldn't happen in the United States at some point? When you look at the...
It just may happen.
Well, Lee, how else do you prepare? You said you're pretty self-sufficient. Do you live off the grid or do you have generators? What do you do?
I don't live off the grid now, but I can do that within a moment's notice. I always follow the little saying that, you know, you live simply so other people can simply live.
Right, right.
And that's my motto, and I kind of like go by that. But yes, most gas stations, the gasoline, you know, like they're run by electric. So if the electric goes out or if we have like people riding in the streets, as soon as the money stops for a lot of people that are subsidized throughout the country, then the whole world would be chaos.
Well, that's true. Let's say, for example, the electricity does go out. And this could happen, you know, without an economic collapse. If we had, for example, a major, major solar storm could knock out grids, the electrical power goes out. The water filtration system in the municipalities are basically dependent on electricity. So forget about, you know, flushing your toilets and having clean water and turning on the taps and so forth. That'll go. You're right. I mean, what happens when the trucks stop moving gasoline to the gas stations, food to the grocery stores? Do you stock up on food? Do you have like a 6-month supply?
Usually 3 months.
3 months.
But yeah, but you see the trends, you know, like the United States, the government lies so much about the situation. I mean, I even believe that there's 30%, 40% unemployment in the United States, but they fiddle around with the figures and things like that. So who knows what's happening in parts of the world?
Well, I believe there's certainly underemployment that would approach at least 20% in the United States, and these job numbers that keep coming out. They neglect to mention that high-paying jobs are going, you know, by the boards, and these are being replaced by service jobs, waitressing and bartending and so forth. So, people are losing 30-40% of their income in some cases. People have 3-4 jobs just to replace, you know, what they once had. So there's huge underemployment, and that figure is not represented in these job stats that come out. I agree. I don't think this is not a recovery. If it is a recovery, it's the worst recovery probably in 150, 200 years. Lee, I appreciate the call. Good to hear from the Buckeye State, Ohio. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Richard. Good night.
416-360-0740 and toll free from just about anywhere. 866-744-740. Do you fear an economic meltdown, a collapse? a depression, a worldwide depression. As I said, Gerald Celente will be on the program in a couple of weeks and will no doubt get into this with him. But all eyes on Cyprus as they struggle to deal with the breakdown of their banking system. And again, many of the people that I follow, the Eric Sprotts and the Jim Sinclairs and the Celentes, say that Cyprus, this could be the domino. This could be that black swan event. This could spread throughout Europe, cause a run on banks, bank failures, the disintegration of the euro. At what point will Germany and its northern EU partners, like Finland and Holland, say enough is enough? We're not going to bail out any more of these Mediterranean countries. What's happening in Cyprus has a lot to do with the fact that the German chancellor is facing an election in September. And many people in Germany are no longer in any mood to bail out these countries. So now Merkel and the Troika are saying to Cyprus, your people will bail out your banking system. Here's the other interesting thing. Part of this deal that's being worked out in these Eurogroup talks, as I speak right now, these talks are underway. The deal is, of course, that 100,000 euro deposits of 100,000 euros and greater will have to pay up to 40% in a depositor tax. Here's the thing, though. The deal is, in exchange for that, they'll get $10 billion in bailout money. But Cyprus was told, you're not gonna have your parliament vote on this. You're gonna put this through, and the people will have no say in it. How undemocratic is that? Carmen is here in Toronto. Carmen, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. How are you?
How are you, Richard?
Hey, Carmen. Good to hear from you. It's been a long time.
Well, I'm a long-time listener, and I think a lot of your guests give us hope and optimism. In fact, many of them have in the past for me. What I hear tonight is scary, but I'm going to mention a name called Ray Kurzweil.
Yes, Ray Kurzweil, yeah.
Yeah, and he wrote a book called The Singularity Is Near, and he said the fundamental laws of the stock market and everything, the financial system, are outdated. Basically, they don't measure the true wealth. According to him, the World Bank released report, and it's about 10 years ago, 2004. It was the most prosperous year ever in any year in history of our recorded civilization. So where is all this money going? I just feel that the money system itself is basically like a flat earth money system, and it doesn't take into account all the wealth that that we really have. And somehow the people in control of the money system, I don't think it's all corrupt. I just think it's complicated, you know. So you say you have Gerald Celente. I like Gerald Celente. I like many of your guests in the past. The fellow, he's a close friend of yours too. Saul?
I'm not sure who you're referring to.
Nelson Thal.
Nelson Thal, yes.
Yeah. I think they're optimistic, and they believe we're in a complex age. But to do with Cyprus, again, I'm not a financial person. All I think of is when I look around in Toronto, I see Brooks Brothers opening. I see all kinds of new stores opening. A lot are closing, like along the Danforth and that. But there's new Target's opening a lot of stores, and for some reason there's 20 stores opening. They must think that, you know, things that there's not going to be a collapse. Again, I'm nothing but a wannabe stand-up comic, and I just when I hear you tonight, it's sort of like.
You sound like you're fairly optimistic, and I agree. Things in Canada are significantly better than they are elsewhere. I think we've we've managed things pretty well here. The conservative government has overall. When we don't have the debt they have elsewhere.
I agree. And we are a wealthy country. We have enormous. Of course, it's not easy to govern. Some groups want to tear it apart. But in any case, it's you've always got a great show. I listen. I don't call as much as I used to, and I don't write as much as I used to, but I'm glad to hear that a lot of stations in the States are going to pick it up, okay?
I appreciate it, Carmen. Good to hear from you.
Okay, man.
Long-time listener, Carmen, from Toronto. Well, I don't want to be a downer, but I think we have to be prepared, right? What's that old saying? Forewarned, forearmed. And if the situation in Cyprus, you know, doesn't turn out to be this domino effect and we don't see this economic tsunami, great, but why not be prepared? Why not be prepared? But I'm curious, especially for people down in the United States, where, let's face it, you have something like one in five people now in the United States are on some form of social assistance, whether it's food stamps, some type of welfare. Again, the unemployment figures that are coming out of the United States, I don't believe them. I think there's huge underemployment. A lot of people have just given up looking for work. You may remember back in February, the CEO of Walmart said, "This is the worst February I've ever seen. It's a disaster." Those were his words, a disaster. Meanwhile, of course, the stock market is going up, 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 new highs approaching 15,000, the Dow. What's going on there? Is that an indication that that we are in recovery? Again, I don't think so. Keep in mind, the Federal Reserve, this quantitative easing, pumping $85 billion a month. Where is that money going? It's going to the banks, so they're liquid. It's going to large corporations. And what are they doing with that money? Acquisitions. Are they hiring people? No. Are they buying their competitors? Are they swallowing their competitors? Yes. And then closing down stores. So the stock market may look good, but I don't think there are any sort of fundamentals. Now, I'm not an economist, but I don't think there are any corporate fundamentals there to support. I don't think there's value, is what I'm saying, in the stock market. And I'm fearing a collapse there as well. Anne is in Keswick, Ontario. Anne, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
Thank you, sir. I'm a little not with the knowledge about the euro, but can you tell me, what would that be in Canadian money when you're talking about the tax that they want to put on the people in Cyprus? What is that value in Canadian money?
Well, a euro right now is about $1.32 Canadian.
Okay.
So let's say you had 100,000 euros.
Yes.
That would be, boy, I need my calculator. But listen, 40%, up to 40%.
Okay.
And let's say it happened in Canada. If you had $100,000 in the bank and you woke up and they said, "We're taxing your deposits by 40%, you now have $60,000 left.
Okay.
That's
now
substantial.
Yes. Even though...
And it's theft, Anne. I need to point that out. This is theft. For years, we've operated under the sacrosanct law that banks insure your deposits. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They need to protect you. That's why you put your money into a bank.
Right.
Now they want to tax you? Listen, got to run, Ann. Listen, if you want to hold on through the break, we'll come back and chat some more. Ann and Keswick stays with us.
I wanted to ask a question.
We'll do that when we come back.
I could hang up.
We'll do that when we come back. The Conspiracy Show, Richard Serrett, back in a moment. Welcome back, and I'm asking you whether you are prepared for a possible financial collapse. And it may seem like a world away, the tiny island nation of Cyprus and what is happening there. But a number of financial analysts, people that I follow, Jim Sinclair, Eric Sprott, and others who contribute to kingworldnews.com, Gerald Salenti, Paul Craig Roberts, Dr. Roberts, was the former assistant secretary of the Treasury, assistant Treasury secretary under Ronald Reagan. He was the architect of Reaganomics. Let me give you a quote from him commenting on what is going on there in Cyprus and this imposition of a tax on depositors, theft. He's talking about a time when a fiduciary actually existed. A fiduciary. that somebody who undertook as a matter of honor and law that the deposits would be protected to the best of that institution's ability. This is something that is completely erased if, in fact, even 0.00001% is taken from the depositors as an act of confiscation in order to save the institutions, which basically have screwed the world and the depositors. When governments don't represent the will of the people, law is in the streets, he writes. What do you think happened in Egypt? What do you think that the basic Arab Spring was all about? What do you think will happen if the present administration in the United States, for example, decides that Texas can't have their guns anymore? Law is moving where it doesn't represent the people, into the streets and away from the legislator. These are defining moments. This is social. This is political. And certainly this is economic. And this is by no means a move too small to consider our world conditions, what is happening in Cyprus. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, the former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury under Ronald Reagan. Let's say hello again to Anne, who's been on hold. Anne is in Keswick, Ontario, and you had a question about the euro and Cyprus, Anne.
Yes. You were saying the banking system in Cyprus has been shut down now for over a week.
Yes.
Should that scenario happen here, that we hope and pray that it doesn't, what my silly little question would be, if the banking system is closed, can you not use your credit card or your debit card in a store? Is that all like the system going to the bank, that everything all down the channels is closed?
Well, what's happened? I'll give you an example of what's happening in Cyprus. And people are allowed to withdraw, I think, 100 euros from an ATM. But stores are nervous that if they were to take a credit card from someone, that they wouldn't be able to get their money out of the bank. So they're only accepting cash. Stores across Cyprus are only accepting cash. So if you don't have cash on hand because they have these capital controls in place and you can only withdraw 100 euros a week, how are you going to buy your groceries?
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in Cyprus. And again, Anne, I want to stress, I don't foresee that ever happening or in the foreseeable future happening in Canada.
No, knock on wood, but
no. We have a very stable banking system.
Yeah.
We don't have, for example, in the United States, they have a huge exposure, their banks, to this, what we call toxic paper, these derivatives,
mm-hmm.
hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives. We don't have that exposure because we have, I guess, just more prudent and smarter bankers up here. They didn't get involved in that nonsense to the same extent, that Ponzi scheme. So the system here is very stable. I think we're okay, Anne.
Okay. Knock on wood.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you for the call, Anne.
Thank
Good
you.
To hear from
Bye.
You. Bye-bye. Michael is in Hamilton. Michael, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm very good, sir. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I just a couple of points that I picked up on here, and this is a really good show you've got going tonight because this is on a lot of people's minds. And I agree with you that I think the Canadian economy and the Canadian banking system is top-notch, and we don't have too much to worry about. But you had a gentleman from Ohio who just called a little while ago.
Yes.
And he said that he thinks that the United States would be the last place that would happen.
I don't agree with that, no.
I don't agree with it at all. And if you back up to the lady that you were just talking to, talking about different things that could happen, and then go back to what this gentleman was saying, first of all, since the United States announced it was $14.7 trillion in debt, and now it's being reported that they're $1.5 to $2 trillion dollars, again, worse than that. And it's been said by people that accountants and financial people can crunch numbers any way they want, and the truth is that it's more like $20 trillion.
Well, I got news for you, Michael. I think, and I've read, it's somewhere near $70 trillion because you need to include what they call these unfunded liabilities.
Yes.
These are things like pensions and so forth. $70 trillion.
It's incredible, and you make a good point. And then when you add up the bankrupt American states that owe what they owe and the bankrupt American cities that owe what they owe, here in Hamilton, last week there was an article by a writer in Detroit, and he was speaking of conditions in Detroit right now.
Michael, listen, I got to take a break. Hold on.
Okay.
I'd like to hear that.
Okay.
Michael from Hamilton, welcoming your calls here on The Conspiracy Show. Are you prepared for a financial collapse? Stay with us. Of course, on the one hand, you could say that at least in Cyprus or the European Union, ECU and the IMF are being a little more honest. They're being a little more upfront in their theft. by taxing depositors. Of course, governments steal from us all the time. There's a secret tax. It's called inflation, the constant devaluing of the dollar. And when they print more money, as they're doing in the United States, to the tune of $85 billion a month, this quantitative easing, in an attempt to stimulate the economy, and it's not doing its job, the recovery just is not, I mean, you could not call this a robust economy by any stretch. But by pumping $85 billion a month into the economy, it's going to cause inflation. It's going to cause hyperinflation at some point. Here again, we're being misled. We're told by the mainstream media that according to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is a basket of goods by which they measure inflation, they're saying, what is it, somewhere between 2 and 3%? Don't buy that. And I don't think any of you buy that either. Have you been to the grocery store lately? Have you seen the price of bread and basic food stuff rising over the last several months? Do you buy that inflation is 2 to 3%? Not a chance. Your utilities? Gas? It's got to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 or 8%. I think we all know that. We all sense that. But again, everybody in the mainstream media and the government telling us everything is okay, everything is looking up and rosy, we're in a recovery. Do you feel like we're in a recovery? Back to Michael in Hamilton. Thanks for holding through the break, Michael.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, just getting back to what we were talking about there, and as soon as President Obama was elected to office, the first thing he did was he came to Canada. He went back and tried to give Americans public health care, and he went back and tried to change banking. He caused the Dow to actually tank. And it was obvious that that system was not working, where you had the savings and loan crisis of the early 80s. You had the recession of the early 90s. This just incredible greed of all of these people that was causing that to happen. And basically knowing that they were going to get bailed out every time that they did something like that. But now it looks like this is nearing the end now. Like with the subprime mortgage thing that was happening when they were flipping properties, and it was just getting absolutely out of control in the United States and Iceland and Ireland and Greece and et cetera. They must have known that those properties weren't worth that much. But it was just flip, 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 money, money, money until it all crashed.
Well, yeah, they bundled this debt into these derivatives. And I don't know, these bond rating agencies that gave them the AAA, they're also guilty here. They looked the other way and gave these AAAs and they went out into the market and they were sold. This derivative bubble, I mean, we're talking hundreds of trillions of dollars.
Yes.
And, I mean, I agree. I think this is going to collapse. I don't know when, but it can't sustain this 100-year-old Ponzi scheme. And I don't know when we get out the other end of it, whether we're going to be back on a gold standard or we'll have to pick some. I read an interesting article the other day, someone suggesting that we can't go back on the gold standard because that can be manipulated the same way that the currency,
yes,
paper money can be manipulated.
Yes.
He was suggesting that we go on a standard that would include something like electricity, like a kilowatt hour. And I found that intriguing. But we definitely have to push the reset button at some point and back the dollar with something of real value.
I agree.
This printing money is it always leads in the same place, and yet we keep going back and making the same mistakes. It's like these guys that are in charge now at the Fed and at the major banks and at the IMF, these are the guys that got us into this mess in the first place.
Exactly.
And they're the ones in charge. And now they're stealing depositor money in Cyprus, and it's going to happen. It's going to spread throughout Europe.
And just thinking what paper money actually is, it's not actually funds. It's a note from the government saying, by us giving you this bill, like a note like they used in Britain, we're giving you this note saying that you're worth this much by the virtue of this piece of paper you're holding in your hand. And in the U.S., it's being handed to you by a government that basically the only reason that they haven't been declared insolvent is because they're the mighty United States.
Well, because they can continue to print money. Now, if you're in the EU, you don't have sovereignty over your own currency. You can't just print your way out of the situation. And that's you're right. If you look at the situation in the United States, they are no better off than Ireland, England, Spain, all these countries that are teetering on the brink. They are bankrupt.
technically, in every sense of the word, the only thing that is keeping them afloat is that they can continue to print money. But when they print money, they devalue the currency. That's theft, because your purchasing power, if you're holding on to paper money, continues to go down. It's a tax. But as I said, at least in Europe now, the European Central Bank and the IMF, they're being totally upfront about it. They're just going into the bank and stealing. They're confiscating depositors' money. Here's an interesting little thing that they had to do, though. They had to redefine what a depositor is in order to pull this prank. A depositor is now being defined as a lender, as an investor. And so, and which of course isn't the case. I mean, you put your money in a bank for safekeeping. You're not an investor. You're not a lender. The bank decides to lend out your money. That's their business, not yours. But in order to confiscate the money from depositors, they had to redefine what a depositor was. 40%, up to 40%, they will tax depositors over 100,000 euros in the banks in Cyprus. If you don't think that's going to cause a run on the banks in places like Spain. Now, incidentally, there are a lot of Brits who have retired to places like Cyprus. And there are a lot of Brits in Spain. If you don't think they're going to run to the bank and pull out their money, if you don't think this could this couldn't happen in the United Kingdom, I beg to differ. So what's happening right now in Cyprus? This could be akin to the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand that set off World War I. In other words, this could be the domino. This could be that black swan event. A ripple turning into a tsunami. And it will have some impact. So what's Germany going to do? Is Germany going to say enough is enough? And they're going to pull out of the EU? I suspect it's only a matter of time before what we see initially is a two-tier European community or a Eurozone. Germany, Finland, Holland, they'll say enough is enough. We're going on our own. They'll have their northern euro. Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, Cyprus, they'll have their southern euro. And then from there, that's just an incremental, a transition. From there, it's just a matter of time before Germany says, no, we're bringing back the Deutschmark. I mean, it'll be a chaos in Europe for a while. You can imagine having to unravel and disentangle from all these contracts that are based, you know, commercial contracts and so forth, based on purchasing in this common currency. But that's where I believe it's going. The euro is unraveling, and this might be the first step. 416-360-0740 in the Greater Toronto Area. Last call to the phones. 1-866-744-740 from just about anywhere. Would love to hear from my listeners in the United States, because I think the situation there is a little more fragile, considerably more fragile than it is here. Do you fear an economic collapse? Are you prepared for one? Do you keep your money under your mattress? Do you think it's possible to wake up one day and there'll be a banking holiday in the United States? Let's say hello to Gail, who I believe is calling from Toronto. Welcome, Gail.
Oh, hi, Richard.
Hi there.
I heard a little while ago, and I don't know whether it's true, but that Austria was going to pull out of the EU and get their own currency back, the shilling. The shilling, what used to be their currency.
I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, this was quite some time ago, and I thought, wow, it sounds like, you know, people are going to be jumping ship pretty soon if Austria pulls out.
Well, this is what Germany has been so afraid of, because
yeah,
they realize it only takes one country, even a tiny country like Cyprus, and once they go, it'll all begin to unravel.
Yeah, well, I think that's maybe what will happen.
We shall see.
Yeah.
I read an interesting thing the other day, though, about Austria.
Mm.
And I forget what the statistic was. It was over 50% I believe, actually, I've posted the story at the website, richardserrett.com, but over 50% of Austrians believe that if the Nazi Party were allowed once again, if it was legal for there to be a Nazi Party in Austria, they would win the next election.
Oh, dear.
This is the ugly side of what's happening.
It's not nice.
No, of course. I mean, in Greece, we've seen the rise of this despicable, horrible party called the Golden Dawn.
Yeah,
and they,
yeah.
While they deny that they are essentially the Nazi Party, that's exactly what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that when times get tough and you see a breakdown in law and order,
right,
and then you see the rise of these parties.
Jackboots take advantage of the situation.
Exactly. Let's pray that we do not see a return, of the rise of the fascists in Europe.
Yeah, because they will take it out on whomever they think is the scapegoat.
Well, and we know exactly how that story ends, don't we? And mm-hmm. It's not good. Gail, thank you for the call. I think we have time to squeeze in Wayne from Scarborough. Wayne, welcome to The Conspiracy Show.
Good evening, Richard. Extra exceptional, interesting show tonight. I'd just like to comment quickly. I think you're on the right track. And what they want to do, though, is make a cashless society. And when they collapse it, they'll say, oh, in time, after the chaos, here's your little chip or your card. Don't worry about it, because banks don't want money. They don't like counting it. The governments don't like printing it. They just got rid of the penny. I'll just throw that out and see what you think, and thank you.
I appreciate that, Wayne. I think you're definitely on to something. I think, though, we've already arrived at a cashless society. Most of your savings are floating around in cyberspace. They're just electronic blips, bouncing around from one credit union to another, from one bank to another financial institution. There's the amount of actual paper currency and coinage that's in circulation is a very small percentage of the money that's out there. Most of it, again, is just electronic. They're little blips moving at the speed of light, and it's a number that's in a computer on a ledger. Goes in one side, it goes out the other. So I think we are in a cashless society, essentially. But it will be interesting to see, if we have this financial collapse, what emerges on the other side? What sort of new financial system is put in place? Will it be a gold standard? Will it be... And perhaps even more interesting, who will emerge... What currency will emerge as the new reserve currency? Will it be the U.S. dollar? I think you could argue that technically it no longer is the reserve currency. China and Russia are now trading directly with each other. They're not using the U.S. dollar. China and Russia no longer using the U.S. dollar, and a number of other countries coming on board. It's getting interesting, folks. Batten down the hatches. You can follow me on Twitter at Richard Serrett. Please say hello.
Toronto, Canada. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Once again, I'd like to welcome our new affiliate, KGY AM 1240 Olympia, Washington. So very proud to be a part of KGY AM, and we'll add KGY AM 1240 to our growing list of affiliates. You know who you are, and thank you. Thank you for including The Conspiracy Show on your weekly schedule. Receiving a lot of email after a recent program on when I asked you whether you're preparing or are you prepared for a possible financial collapse, and some of the email very positive, saying you know great show. Others thought I was being a little gloomy, but I think we need to be prepared. We need to be prepared, and if you know we come out the other side and we are in fact in a recovery. What's the harm? What's the harm in storing, you know, 3 months' worth of food supply and water? What's the harm in going out and buying a little physical gold and putting that in a safe place? I think that's just prudent. And let's hope it never comes to that. But I think we need to be prepared. I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball, you know, and could see just 6 months from now to see how is this thing going to work out. You know, I was reading actually someone sent me this. This is an old story that actually appeared. It was the front page of the New York Times a couple of years ago. And it was a serious story about ESP, again, on the front page of the New York Times. And so someone sent me this. I just want to read you a little bit of it. I think this is very interesting. One of psychology's most respected journals has agreed to publish a paper presenting what its author describes as strong evidence for extrasensory perception, the ability to sense future events. The decision may delight believers in so-called paranormal events, but it is already mortifying scientists. Advanced copies of the paper to be published this year, again, this was 2011, to be published this year in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, have circulated widely among psychological researchers in recent weeks and have generated a mixture of amusement and scorn. The paper describes 9 unusual lab experiments performed over the past decade by its author, Daryl J. Bem, an emeritus professor at Cornell, testing the ability of college students to accurately sense random events, like whether a computer program will flash a photograph on the left side or the right side of its screen. The studies included more than 1,000 subjects. Some scientists say the report deserves to be published in the name of open inquiry. Others insist that its acceptance only accentuates fundamental flaws in the evaluation and peer review of research in the social sciences. Quote, "It's craziness, pure craziness. I can't believe a major journal is allowing this work in," said Ray Hyman, an emeritus professor of psychology at the University of Oregon and longtime critic of ESP research. "I think it's just an embarrassment for the entire field," end quote. The editor of the journal, Charles Judd, a psychologist at the University of Colorado, said the paper went through the journal's regular review process. 4 reviewers made comments on the manuscript, he said, and these are very trusted people. It's interesting. When scientists actually look into ESP, they conduct studies under scientific conditions and come up with positive results, it's still not good enough for what I'll call orthodox scientific thinking. They will still scorn it and dispute it. Well, my next guest is also a man of science, and he's also studied ESP. He's a physicist, author, and was a pioneer in the development of the laser and laser applications. He holds his Bachelor of Science in Physics from Queen's College and did graduate work in physics at Columbia University. He's received 2 National Aeronautics and Space Administration Awards for inventions and contributions in lasers and laser communications. He's published over 100 scientific papers on lasers, plasma physics, and ESP research. In the 1970s and 1980s, Russell Targ co-founded and worked for the CIA-sponsored Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities. His work in this new area called remote viewing was published in Nature.
the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, and in Proceedings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. In 1983 and 1984, he accepted invitations to present remote viewing demonstrations and address the USSR Academy of Sciences on his research. In 1997, Russell Targ retired from Lockheed Martin Missiles and Space as a senior staff scientist, where he developed airborne laser systems for the detection of wind shear. He now teaches remote viewing workshops worldwide and continues to write. He is a co-author of 8 books dealing with the scientific investigation of psychic abilities, including Limitless Mind, A Guide to Remote Viewing, Transformation of Consciousness, and his autobiography, Do You See What I See? Memoirs of a Blind Biker. His latest book is entitled The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. Russell Targ, welcome to The Conspiracy Show. How are you?
I'm very happy to be with you. You said so many things in your introduction that's interesting for me. In Judaism, they say there's no ox like an orthodox. You say orthodox science doesn't know what to make out of psychic abilities. And the New York Times did indeed publish a precognitive criticism of Daryl Bem's paper that was going to publish 6 months later. So I thought that's very unusual.
It's almost like they were setting him up when they published that paper, when they published that article, rather, on the front page.
That's right. It was ridiculous. They're criticizing a paper that had not yet been published.
Yeah, we see that time and time again.
They looked into the future and saw they weren't going to like it.
How does a physicist pioneering the development of lasers and laser applications, how did you first get involved in the study of ESP?
Well, I got involved in ESP growing up in New York City, where I was interested in stage magic. So I used to do magic where I would pretend to read the minds of people in the audience, and I would occasionally have flashes or pictures pertaining to the life situation of the person whose mind I was pretending to read. And as a young scientist, I decided that it was more interesting to learn about the research in parapsychology than to just continue fooling people. So I met J.B. Rhine and read the journals and became affiliated with the Theosophical Society and learned that there's quite a lot of serious work going on by psychologists at that time investigating psychic abilities. This is now 50 years later, and the physicists have pretty much taken over from the psychologists, with the exception of Daryl Bem. That is, modern physics is very interesting. I went to 2 major conferences, University of California, San Diego, dealing with what physicists call retrocausality. Physicists are interested in how photons can affect one another before they've actually reached the 2 slits, and you have interference where one photon seems to know that the other one is coming. So this is a hot topic in modern physics called retrocausality. Daryl Bem is interested in how it is that you do better if you study for an exam after you take it. In one of his experiments that was my favorite in the series of 9, is he would show students 48 words, and you'd have to remember them as best you can. You see a word every 2 seconds, and the experiment is remember all the words you can, and when you're done, write down all the words you remember. That's the experiment. Very simple. After they're done with that, he will then show them half those words and say, write down whether each of those remaining 24 words are animal, vegetable, or mineral. Pay attention to them. And even though the later words are chosen randomly, students will remember the words that they saw at a later time in greater abundance than the words that they didn't get feedback on. So it says, when you take an exam in school, if there's a question you can't answer, run home and find out what the answer is. It will help you on your exam.
Makes sense.
And good students always go over the exam right after they take it. It's a common thing for a serious student to do.
Right after
you take a final exam or a midterm, you immediately sit down with your friend and go over the exam and say, "Was there any anything there you didn't understand. And that would improve your score, according to the published papers of Daryl Bem. It's like a precognitive dream. Precognitive dreams are the first experience that many people have in the psychic realm, where you dream on a Sunday night that you see an elephant walking down the main street in Toronto. Now, it's been a long time since there's an elephant walking down the main drag, if ever. So you have this dream, and you tell your partner, I had this crazy dream about an elephant, and it was not a wish fulfillment dream. It's not something I'm worried about. It is a very clear dream that I had Sunday night. And then Monday morning on television, you see that the zoo is coming to Toronto, and the elephant escaped from the zoo and was rampaging down the street. So I would say that Monday morning's picture of the elephant running down the street was the cause, the trigger, or your having the dream the previous night. And a lot of that is going on.
Sure is. It sure is.
People often have dreams triggered by what they see the following day.
Well, I think we all do, but we don't keep this. This is why it's important, I think, to keep a dream journal, to write down what you dreamt, because it's, you know, many of us have these, but then we don't pay attention, we forget, and it slips by us. But how did it happen for you at Stanford? How does a prestigious institution like Stanford University, it's really astounding that they would get involved in something like this. I tend to think of these institutions as incredibly conservative, skeptical.
Well, this is Stanford Research Institute.
Right.
It's not quite as stodgy as the university. My colleague Hal Puthoff and I were already well known as laser pioneers. So we had done a lot of stuff, and we were known in the community as people who were able to do difficult tasks. So that I was at a meeting, a NASA meeting, and I had support from Wernher von Braun and James Fletcher, the administrator of NASA, that they would help support a program if I found a home for it. So I went to SRI with Puthoff and said, I got money from NASA. Von Braun said it's okay. Edgar Mitchell will support us. And Charlie Anderson, the president of SRI, said, you can do this if you keep a low profile. And we did our best to do that until Uri Geller came along.
Okay, listen, Russell, I've got to take a timeout. We'll come back. Some pretty heavy hitters getting behind you at Stanford Research Institute. Russell Targ is my guest, and his latest book is called The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities, right here on The Conspiracy Show. Don't go away. Russell Targ is with us, co-founder of the CIA-sponsored Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities. His work in this new area called remote viewing was published in Nature, the Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, and in Proceedings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And his new book is entitled The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Ability. So back to the Stanford Research Institute.
The reason that I say we have proof of psychic abilities,
yes,
is that the evidence is so strong it would be statistically unreasonable to deny it at this point. We've done many, many experiments now, statistically significant, of odds a million to one or more. And the statistical significance of our work is 10 times greater, or more than 10 times greater, the proof that aspirin prevents heart attacks. So the National Institutes of Health, NIH in Washington, did experiments to show that aspirin prevents heart attacks. And they stopped the experiment early because it was so clear that the people getting the aspirin had better outcomes, that they didn't want to deprive the control people of the aspirin. The effect size, the strength of our experiments, is more than 10 times greater than the proof that aspirin prevents heart attacks.
So let's talk about some of these experiments. I've sort of studied or followed some of the experiments of people like Cliff Pickover and Dr. Gary Schwartz with his blinded field experiment. about precognitive dreams, which you were discussing earlier. Tell me about some of the experiments that are going on. Well, let's start with Stanford Research Institute and some of those early experiments.
Well, the experiment that convinced me beyond doubt that psychic abilities are real is we're working with a psychic policeman, Pat Price.
Yes.
And CIA was very interested in him because he's the only one we ever had who could read things at a distance. And the things that he was assigned to read were file drawers in the National Security, the NSA.
Yes.
In America, they call it NSA, stands for No Such Agency. So he was given the coordinates of the NSA in Virginia, and he described what it looked like and was then able to read the names on the file drawers. And the NSA got very angry about that. They said, why did you pick the most secure place in the whole country to target these guys? You made a big problem for us. And a few weeks later, we got a call from the police department of Berkeley, California, telling us Patricia Hearst had been kidnapped, which we already knew.
Right.
And they didn't know what to do. She's kidnapped by a terrorist organization. They didn't know anything about them. The SLA, Symbionese Liberation Army, they were looking for Symbia on the map and couldn't find it. Could we help? And Pat said, sure I can. That's what I did as a police commissioner all my life. I can do that. So Price and my colleague Hal Putoff and I went to Berkeley, and Price immediately said, just show me the mug book. Show me the picture book with all the usual suspects. And he turned page after page and then put his finger on a guy. That's where the expression, he fingered him. And he said, that's the ringleader. That was Donald DeVries, and that was the right answer. No one knew that on that day. We didn't know that till the end of the week and when DeVries surfaced. But Price pulled him out spontaneously from this big picture book. And Price said, but if you really want some help, I could tell you where the kidnap car is, the white station wagon, and I see it about 50 miles north of here on the right side of the freeway in a gravel driveway in front of a diner, and on the other side of the freeway are two big white gas storage tanks, and there's a pedestrian overpass across the freeway. This is what Price has volunteered, very much like I just said it to you. No meditation, no huffing and puffing. Oh, you want the car that's 50 miles north on the right. And one of the detectives said, well, I know where that is. It's on the way to my house in Vallejo, north of here. 20 minutes later, a police car was sent to the diner. They found the station wagon, and there were still cartridges rolling around on the floorboards of the station wagon that matched the cartridges we had seen earlier in the day rolling around under the bed of Patricia Hearst's little accommodations at UC Berkeley. So we knew for a fact that they had found the car, and took Price essentially no time standing in the police station with a mug book in front of him to tell the police where to go to find the kidnap car. And I still think of that as that's as close to magic as I've ever seen.
That is remarkable.
It's a person whose awareness just fills all of space and all of time. Ask me anything, and I'll tell you the answer.
And was Pat Price, was he reliable what was his reliability? Was he 100%? Was he 80%? What was he?
Well, the formal experiment we did, which is a kind of psychic hide-and-go-seek, that we had 60 possible hiding places in the San Francisco Bay Area that were put together by my colleague and the division director, and I didn't know those. I didn't want to know them. And then each day in this series of 9 trials, they would randomly choose one of these target locations after I was sequestered with Price in an electrically shielded room. And then a half hour later, my partner and a CIA agent or a lab director would go to one of these sites. So I would be sitting with Price and say, okay, Hal's at his location now. What do you see? What's Hal experiencing? And Price would say something like, I see a watery area. There's a cross. There's two walkways crossing each other. It's like a botanical garden. And that was the day they went to the botanical garden. Another day, he said, I see a boat dock with little boats with their masts stepped, and there's a Chinese-looking restaurant next to it. And that was the day they went to the boat dock. So we did nine of those, and Pat Price generated nine transcripts, like I've just described to you. And they had to be matched in a blind fashion with the formal driving instructions to the place. So a SRI analyst would take the nine transcripts and the nine directions and go to the nine places and try and match them up. And by you would expect one first-place match and one second-place match, one third-place match, so forth. Well, he got seven first-place matches.
Mm.
So what that means is that if Hal Puthoff had been kidnapped 7 days in a row, if Hal had been kidnapped 9 days in a row, Price would have found in the first place he looked in seven out of the nine trials.
That's
so
remarkable.
He was seven out of nine first-place matches, odds of better than one in a million.
My word. And this was repeated, I'm guessing.
We had publishing that in the proceedings of the IEEE or Nature. It was a very clean experiment.
Would you have trouble publishing that study today?
I don't know that. It was a very good experiment. Hal and I were well known in the scientific community. We did another experiment. We were asked by the CIA to find somebody who was not a famous psychic, and I chose my friend Hella Hammett, who is a Life magazine photographer, and we did the psychic hide-and-go-seek, where I'm again the psychic tour guide sitting in the dark with the viewer trying to elicit from her the information. And we did nine trials with her, and she was even more successful than the police commissioner.
My word. My word.
So we published those two trials together, both in Nature and in the IEEE. And people all over the world have done that. So that if you go to Google now, you'll find 2.5 million pages dealing with remote viewing. It's a lot of pages for something people don't think exists.
Or they may know of the CIA funded program, but they don't necessarily believe that it works. Now, the CIA and was the Department of Defense also one of the backers of this program?
Yes, Army Intelligence Command, what we call INSCOM, supported us and wanted us to set up a Army Psychic Corps in Maryland at Fort Meade.
Yes.
So we chose 30 Army intelligence people to investigate, and of those 30, we chose six to work with us. So we did a similar training. We had each of our six selectees who would spend a week with us. We'd do six trials with each of them. So at the end of 6 weeks, we had 36 trials with these people. And again, you'd expect one-sixth of them to be first place. You'd expect six first-place matches, and we had 19 first-place matches. It's hugely significant working with not particularly psychic people. These are Army officers that we chose based on an interview that we just made up. We're not psychologists. We just interviewed all these people, and from the 30 we talked to, we chose six who, in our assessment, as physicists, we chose to be psychic people. And these people did outstandingly well. And that gave us the idea, increasingly, that remote viewing may not be so hard to do. We think that it may be a general ability that many, many people are able to quiet their mind and describe the images in their awareness corresponding to what's going on and what it looks like at a distant location.
How successful was this Corps of Psychic Spies during the Cold War? What sort of things?
They're very successful. The way to measure the success of our program is that we started in 1972, and we were supported $2 million a year for the next 23 years by CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, Army Intelligence, NASA, and Navy, and other U.S. Air Force intelligence. So we were supported 23 years as a functioning part of military intelligence, providing information. And it's very, very hard to get continuing follow-on support to do anything in the scientific world. To say, we had a very good year, we'd like to continue this experiment for another couple of years, very hard to get follow-on support. The fact that we were supported continuously by the same group of agencies for 23 years is, in a way, the best evidence that I could offer you that we were doing something useful, because they wouldn't keep supporting us if we weren't doing something useful.
Exactly. And yet, I believe, I forget which CIA director said this, but
Robert Gates,
interesting, said that the reason that this program was shut down was that it wasn't effective.
I know you'd be very shocked if I told you that CIA agents sometimes lie.
I would be absolutely shocked.
And so that was not true. He said it was shut. He shut it down because he didn't like defending something that he was teased for, since at that time we did not have a good idea how ESP works. And he would be happy as a government bureaucrat to get rid of the psychics in California if, as he said, America no longer has any serious enemies anymore. Cold War is over. The Berlin Wall is down. We don't need to support the psychic army corps, is what he said.
Are you still bound by sort of operating under the security clearance? I mean, are you able to divulge certain projects that the psychic corps was involved in?
I can describe pretty much everything that was done, because I have a letter. Yeah, I'm eager not to go to jail just like everybody else. So I have a letter from the CIA with slightly redacted copies of the reports that I talk about, and I published the letter from the CIA.
Now, how, in were there instances during the Cold War where this psychic, these psychic spies that you helped train, perhaps were able to avert some sort of Cold War catastrophe, locating a target that was crucial, during that period?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I don't know of anything we were able to avert. My favorite question that pertains to that kind of causality. We had an experiment that was a lot like that. Early in the program, the CIA asked Ingo Swann, who's the one who taught us all how to do remote viewing.
Yes.
They asked Swann, what's going on at these coordinates, latitude and longitude, on Thursday? And this is Monday. So 3 days from now, what will be happening at this location? And Swann said, it looks to me like some kind of pyrotechnic explosion. I see beautiful arcs and sparks in the sky, hemispherical, colorful displays, and the row of trucks in the background. And with that information and what they had already suspected, the CIA was able to say, yes, the Chinese will do the atomic bomb test that we thought they were going to do, and it's going to fail.
Remarkable. Listen, Russell, I got to jump in here. I got to jump in.
What Swann described is a failed test.
Amazing. Okay, let me take a time out. We'll come back. Russell Targ, the reality of ESP here on The Conspiracy Show. Russell Targ is with us, co-founder of the CIA-sponsored Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities and this new field at the time called remote viewing, the development of psychic spies for the U.S. Army. You mentioned Ingo Swann, of course, who just passed away.
I can say, in the reality of ESP, in my new book, I also tell people how to learn to do remote viewing. Because I have a chapter called Working with a Partner, where you and your partner can develop your psychic abilities and learn to separate the psychic signal from the mental noise, as Ingo taught us to do. And you're going to remind your listeners that Ingo was the father of remote viewing, and he unfortunately died a few weeks ago.
Yes, back in, I guess it was January. Now, was he one of the best?
Yes, Ingo and Pat Price and Hella Hammett and Joe McMonagle were the best remote viewers that we saw. So they were in a class by themselves. But we've seen a lot of other really excellent remote viewing. Many people in the Army Psychic Corps did well, and we had other people at SRI who did well.
What made them so special? If this is something that anyone can learn, and I'm guessing they had no formal training, was this just, I mean, are they more highly tuned? What is it about? What was it about?
I think it's like a musical ability. That is, anybody can learn to play the piano somewhat. You can learn to play a little Mozart, a little Bach, make yourself happy, amuse your friends. But by and large, no matter how much you practice, it's not going to get you to Carnegie Hall. And remote viewing's like that. With a little, when I have a workshop, I may have a couple of dozen people or 40 people. What I promise, and people have spent a lot of money to do this and come from far away, and I promise them that everybody will either do something psychic or see something psychic. And what I mean by that is within our 2 or 3 days together and maybe doing 6 different remote viewing activities, everybody will either have a striking hit describing an object very, very well, or their neighbor will describe their object very well. So I've been teaching now for a decade all over the world, and I've never had anybody complain to me or the management, and gee, I heard a lot about this stuff. It doesn't seem to work. It's this kind of magic is easier to do than you might think.
What does it say about the human mind and consciousness that we have this ability?
It says that our consciousness is non-local. The modern physics has finally caught up with this. This is a old, this remote viewing is not new age. That is, 1,200 years ago, the Buddhists were writing in detail about how to quiet your mind and move from a space of suffering where you're spending time defending your ego, and you can move from this conditioned awareness into spacious or naked awareness where you can see the universe as it really is. And Padmasambhava, who's a great Buddhist teacher of the 8th century, wrote a book a lot like an earlier book of mine. His book is called Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness. It's how to move from conditioned awareness into the spacious realm. And he described in detail how to get rid of mental noise, how to give up your desire to name and grasp onto your images, and entirely understood and practiced 1,200 years ago and earlier than that. And I have a chapter in my book about early Buddhist teachings where you can see in the distance, where they talk in detail about looking into the, seeing into the distance, seeing into the future, diagnosing the ill, healing the sick, talking to the dead, remembering past lives, with recipes for how to do that.
The reality of ESP, a physicist's proof of psychic abilities. So how does ESP work then? Does it have anything to do with quantum physics?
It does not have anything to do with quantum physics. It has to do with the nature of the space and time in which we live. A consequence of quantum physics, one of the things that makes quantum physics work, is the idea that we live in a non-local space-time, that is a multidimensional space-time where some things that were born together remain entangled with one another. So Ernst Schrödinger, the great physicist in the 1920s, who perfected quantum mechanics, noticed that it was predicted that if photons are born together, they remain entangled, travel away from each other at the speed of light, and if you grab the one on the left, it will affect the one on the right. Einstein hated that idea, talked about spooky connection at a distance, and then in the 1970s that was proved to be correct, and experiments at Berkeley, and then experiments in Paris, and lately experiments in Budapest by Anton Zeilinger, who has done many, many experiments showing that these entangled photons do affect one another, even though they're traveling at the speed of light away from each other. And this is all because we live in a non-local space-time. So these photon experiments are not the cause of ESP, but the fact that we live in a non-local space-time allows the photons to be entangled and you and me to be entangled as well.
All right, Russell, we'll take another time out. We'll come back and expound on that point. I guess before the Big Bang, all photons were entangled, so it stands to reason that after the Big Bang, they remain thus. The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Hang around. Welcome back. Just a programming note. Next week, as we approach the 45th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, William Francis Pepper will be on the program. William Francis Pepper was the lawyer, the last lawyer for James Earl Ray, and in fact launched a civil trial in Memphis in 1999, which exonerated James Earl Ray. The jury came back and said that James Earl Ray was not responsible for the assassination of the civil rights leader, Dr. King. Also joining us on the program will be the former member of the House of U.S. House of Representatives, Cynthia McKinney, who is, during her time in Congress, very active in trying to see a number of papers relating to his King's assassination released to the public. So that's next week, William Francis Pepper and Cynthia McKinney right here on the program. Russell Targ, physicist, author, co-founder of the remote viewing program at the Stanford Research Institute, is with me, and his new book is The Reality of ESP, A Physicist's Proof of Psychic Abilities. A skeptic would say, and I'm sure you've heard all the arguments, Russell, but a skeptic might say, well, if this ability exists, why wouldn't, for example, someone like an Ingo Swann have become a multi-millionaire if they could foresee, for example, stock market prices or the rise of gold and silver? I know you did an experiment involving silver.
I can tell you two stories about that. Just before you called me, I was reading the New York Times, as I do every Sunday, and I read the financial page, and I saw the problem in Cyprus has been resolved. And I thought, that could happen in America. Maybe I should get some cash. And I actually walked in another room and proposed to my wife that we should get a couple of $1,000 in cash and just have it in the house in case of a calamity. Now, we've been married for a decade, never talked about any fears about a crash or hiding money or having cash, blah, blah, blah. 1 hour later, I'm on the show with you, and your commercial says it's very important to have some cash or gold in the house because of the coming conspiracy. So a person interested in psychic things might say that your voice of doom and gloom saying, be ready for the collapse, have some money at the house, that event might have triggered my fearful thoughts an hour before. It's not a striking event, except I've never had thoughts. I've never had cash in the house, never thought about doing it, and that's exactly what you're...
That's what we talked about. Yes, we talked about
that. That's what they instructed me to do. So what I would say is that my radio program at 9 o'clock caused me to have the fearful thoughts at 8 o'clock and start thinking about calamity and...
Right. But you also used remote viewing to invest in the silver market, didn't you?
Yes, we did. So apart from my puny little experience with the newspaper, we actually made $120,000 forecasting silver. And Ingo is not the viewer. Another experienced remote viewer did that for us. Right after it left SRI, I created a company called Delphi Associates. And each week for 9 weeks, we would forecast whether the market would go up a little or up a lot, down a little or down a lot. And we were correct each of our calls. We were correct 9 weeks in a row. in a 1-in-4 game, and that's how we made our $100,000. It's very hard to do anything in life 9 times in a row correctly. And this was published on the front page of the Wall Street Journal the following year, and then Nova and BBC Horizon made a film featuring this, interviewing people on Wall Street, talking to our broker, and verifying that we really did this. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it's very hard to read anything. So in this case, it would be nice to have the psychic read the big board on the commodity exchange. But instead, we did something called associative remote viewing, where he had to describe the correct object on the broker's desk. There was an up object and a down object and so forth. Each week we'd have different objects, and the viewer had to describe, what will I put in your hand next Friday? You can't read the board at the commodity exchange, but you can describe what I'm going to put in your hand. We call that associative remote viewing. And in my book, In the Reality of ESP, I describe in detail how we did that forecasting. And there is now a increasing interest, partly because of Daryl Bem's work, partly because of some indefatigable workers from the Army Psychic Program. We now have a organization called International Remote Viewing Association. It's irva.org. And they're very interested in applying psychic ability. It's not a science organization. I've been trying for 40 years to get them to publish their work, but they're interested in finding lost children, investing in the market, investing in sporting games, that is to say, gambling. So IRV is interested in applied remote viewing, but your listeners might like to go to the website, irva.org. Or if you want to find out what I'm doing, I have a website, which is espresearch.com.
I've linked up to your site as well on my site, Russell. So, yes, ESP Research.
If people want to communicate with me, they can just go to my website and I'll answer their email. But we were perfectly successful in forecasting silver, and there's now quite a lot of activity. I do most of my email on my cell phone, and my phone is just chiming along during the day with a variety of people who are having success both in forecasting the market and in sporting events, principally in sporting events because the odds are better.
You mentioned the CIA director, Robert Gates, at the time basically shutting down the program because of some – it was a – because he was embarrassed.
He didn't like being teased.
Right. But do you suspect...
The Cold War was over. We were no longer worried about having a bomb dropped on our head.
But do you suspect...
Let's get rid of this psychic nonsense.
But do you suspect, though, that that program is still at some level operating under the radar? If it's so successful, I mean, why wouldn't they keep it?
Well, I suspect that it's not.
Hmm.
There could be a ESP program in the basement of the Pentagon that I don't know about. That's definitely possible. I would say that's under 10% likelihood because it requires a group of people in the government who are both very intelligent and very courageous, and I don't see any people like that right now.
What about the Russians or the Chinese?
The Russians and the Chinese were endeavoring to do remote viewing, but they were not so successful. The Chinese... claim success and just do lousy experiments. That is, China has a Confucian problem in that you can't criticize a person's experiment or they get very angry with you, like criticizing their wife or their children. So Chinese do experiments, but they're generally terrible experiments, ill-conceived. The Russians were unable to have the success that we had because it's hard to be psychic in a slave state. Because in order to be psychic, you have to be willing to be wrong. But in England and Scandinavia and Iceland and Italy, there's lots of psychic work published. In fact, the most psychic group of people I've ever met are the Italian women who took part in my experiment, who were much more psychic as a group than anybody else I ever worked with. And I don't understand that. That's a research program available to somebody. Why are the Italian women so strikingly more psychic than, say, the women of Silicon Valley?
Interesting. Very interesting. Something in the culture, perhaps? I don't know.
They have more permission to be what they want to be.
Perhaps. And police departments are utilizing psychics all the time, but they don't publicly acknowledge it. I guess, again, this embarrassment factor. But
there are now several books about police using psychic ability, and that's another activity at the International Remote Viewing Association. IRVA is very interested in working with the police, and there are several groups of people there helping police find criminals.
Why is the scientific community so aggressively antagonistic towards this kind of research? I mean, there are some brave people like yourself, and I mentioned Dr. Gary Schwartz and others, but by and large, the science community wants no part of this, and if any study comes out, they pile on and try and discredit it. What's at stake for them?
Well, remember that there's a lot of fraud. I mean, in the Victorian times, there are a lot of fake mediums, and you can walk down every street in a big city and there's somebody reading your fortune, reading your palm, telling you what's going to happen. So a lot of fake, it's like bad money drives out good money. Every time you get a fake fortune teller, it makes it harder for a genuine scientist, to avoid looking like a flake. Say, oh yeah, you want to investigate the future? Isn't that what Madame Catherine does down the street? So it's hard to be taken seriously until we have a good theory for how it works.
But even when they're presented with this, with data and good scientific studies, they still won't accept it, it seems.
Well, to get our work published by the radio and electrical engineers, we had to go to Bell Labs and demonstrate remote viewing and set up an experiment to be done by the editor of the journal. He did an experiment. He would hide every day for 5 days and have somebody in his group try and describe which place he had gone to hide, and that worked perfectly, and he published my paper. So the empirical value works out. When we make a lot of money in the market, we again get a lot of attention. So I encourage people to consider moving into the spacious realm, consider sitting quietly and realizing that their awareness is non-local. It is not true that who they are is what they see in the mirror in the morning. That's a big cause of suffering. You're much more spacious than that, and you can incorporate these psychic abilities into your life in a variety of ways.
How long would it take me, Russell, if I wanted to become a really good remote viewer?
Well, if you wanted to experience remote viewing, I would say work with a friend, and within a week you will be seeing psychic things happening that you'll be telling people about. It probably takes a few more weeks to get better and better. The trick is to separate the psychic signal from the mental noise. If I tell you I've got an object on my desk and I want you to describe it, you'll say, I know what it is, it's a Swiss Army knife. And I will say, no, don't tell me the name. Just describe the image that comes into your awareness. Tell me about the shape and the form. And it takes you about a week to definitively give up your desire to name the thing and just describe the shape and the form and the color. Because in the psychic realm, things don't have names. That is, you have to describe just what it looks like and what you're experiencing.
Just a collection of tightly packed atoms, really, aren't they? Russell, a real pleasure to meet you. I'd love to have you on again. Perhaps sometime we could do a remote viewing experiment on the air.
I could do that.
I'd love to. Again,
thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. The Reality of ESP, Russell Targ. Thank you. Tim
bye
Spreen.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Tim Spreen, thank you to you. Back next week. Again, William Francis Pepper, Cynthia McKinney, the state execution of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the meantime, don't be afraid. Nothing concealed that won't be revealed. Nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home. Good night.